You know we have to arrest him, right? We are still cops.
And honestly, most of you are complicit in all of this.
Especially you, Ichijo. Welcome to the Commentary Track, a Kamen Rider podcast. I'm your host, Jared.
I'm Cody.
And I'm producer, Jed.
Well, boys, this is the final episode of Kuga.
Yeah, I want to congratulate you guys. This is going to sound silly and self-aggrandizing, but there are a lot of people who like set out to start a podcast, but few stick with it and fewer finish a subject. But we did. We started off in kind of a rocky place. We didn't really have our schedule set, and it took us some time to get our feet that way. Some life events came up and were overcome, but we made it through an entire series, and that's pretty cool.
That is. You know, we haven't done this for the last couple episodes because we've been so focused on things, but how's it going?
Fuck daylight savings time.
Did you lose some editing hours? Lost one, felt like five.
Yeah, I actually thought that myself and Bug had slept in and then remembered that the time changed and nope, this is our normal time waking up. Damn.
I got sucked into Helldivers 2 last night. Katie had promised me, since we were recording fairly early today, she's like, hey, can you come to bed by like 1 o'clock? Just make sure you're not overtired and cranky tomorrow morning so we actually get some hangout time. I was like, you know what? It's fair. I can do that. Time gets up there. I'm paying attention. I got alarm set, man. I'm ready. I guess my phone didn't update immediately because I'm looking at my phone. I'm like, okay, guys, it's 12:45. I don't have time to start another round. I got to go to bed. Go to bed. Turn off all the lights, shut everything down, check my phone one more time, and it says 2:45. I was like, son of a bitch. Daylight savings time. I apologize, Katie. I was like, I'm sorry that, you know, the way we arbitrarily designate time made a liar out of me. My bad.
We need to just do away with it.
We do. It served a purpose, but it's become vestigial.
And I know that our government had the proposal to, like, make it permanent. No, no. We revert back to standard time, and we never go to daylight savings ever again.
Yeah, I just find it funny, like, there's one reservation that doesn't respect daylight savings time within a state that does reflect daylight savings time.
No, it's the other way around, because Arizona doesn't do it, but the reservation does.
Right, so the wider country has one perspective, Arizona has another one, and then the reservation has a different perspective on time. You can change time zones, I think, 4 times within about 12 minutes of driving, if you do it correctly.
Yeah.
Amazing.
This country is stupid.
Yeah, none of this is made up at all.
Nah. And also, time zones in general being super arbitrary, because, like, all of China is one single time zone.
Yeah.
But we're 4.
I changed time zones going to Pensacola.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the reason that that's there is because a newspaper magnate in Florida changed where the arbitrary cutoff point in Florida was. Because he wanted his plant to be Eastern time, because that's where he and Jacksonville had. And he hated initially that being like, I want information now. Well, hey, it's this time there. So he paid to have the time zone moved so that his plant was now in the same time zone.
You want to know what power looks like? That's power. Dagobah's a salty little boy who wants to throw fists. That man changed time so he could get his reports at the hour he wanted them.
Yes.
That's power. Well, here we are. We left off last episode with our main character and our BBEG both on the ground in the snow. Now, we did our wrap-up, we did our Monster Mash, and we did our review of Dagobah, and we talked about him. He was rated very, very highly, but we haven't seen either one of them stand up. So whether or not he's quote-unquote dead is still a mystery to me and Jared.
Fair enough. You know, we have the word of the producer that we ranked him because he's dead, but yeah, I need some sort of confirmation.
Yeah, Jetty's played jokes on us before.
So with that, I guess we're just going to go ahead and jump into episode 49, Yusuke.
I, for one, am just absolutely tickled to see this intro one more time.
Episode 49 was written by Arakawa Naruhisa and directed by Ishida Hidenori. It originally aired on January 21st, 2001.
Stop, 이름은 버려, Mr. Rover, 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 I'm coming over, over, over.
A jump to the sky turns to a rider review.
What a nice send-off.
Yeah, this was a really pleasant way to end things.
Would you like to take us through it one more time?
Why not? So we start off with the sky.
Just a
blue sky, lightly cloudy. And we get the opening credits. And surprisingly, they're still the visual changes from the last few episodes.
Yeah, that was an interesting choice.
I expected them to snap back to normal, but...
Yeah, I'm not sure what we're supposed to read into that, honestly.
I guess just a constant evolution. It could play into what one character says later on. We can sort of circle back to that when we get there.
Or that some damage is permanent. Yeah, that's deep as shit.
Well, let's go with it.
Yeah.
So from there, we cut to police headquarters, and also we've jumped forward in time 3 months. And that brings us to this week's Tropusatsu.
So soon.
Distant finale. Time marches ever onward. You know, with the exception of those with the money to redefine time zones, you can't change it.
How topical.
I swear that I was not thinking of the Tropusatsu when I brought up that story.
No, spectacular. It's even better.
So a distant finale is, of course, a finale that is set sometime after the climax of the story rather than immediately after. Here we are sitting 3 months later. It's not Godai standing back up and confirming that Daguva is dead. How long varies from series to series? Usually it's more than a few years, like Darling in the Franxx, where they jump forward a couple hundred years for literally the very last scene of the show.
Yay.
So these sort of finales are used to show what has happened to the cast, to the world, in the intervening time, showing whether things have gone back to some semblance of normal, or, you know, we don't have to see the rebuilding process. We just get to see here is what has happened now. The fact that we only jump forward 3 months is a fairly mild example of this, but still, you know, we miss 3 months of excessive paperwork and rebuilding damage. So many funerals in Nagano. Probably for the best.
Everybody's wondering why Godai dipped, but with the amount of paperwork they were going to have to fill out about all this, and the accountability and the investigations and liability, it's really not that much of a mystery. Ichijo's like, dude, you gotta fucking leave.
The fact that everybody else chose to stay around, honestly, as accomplices, is concerning.
So I'm curious, with this particular trope, would this also apply to an epilogue, or is that its own thing? Like, do epilogues technically constitute a jump forward if they take a time skip? Or is this mostly for the entrenched part of the story, where the last part of the story is told in the future?
So I would argue that something like at the end of Return of the King, where the story has ended, but there are the appendixes that jump forward in the future. The appendixes do not count because the story had a solid ending. It had a finale. Those are epilogue.
Okay.
But for this one, we didn't have an established. We have the climactic battle, and then we skip forward.
Gotcha.
So at police headquarters, Ichijo is looking through a report that amazingly helped clear up what I thought certainly was going to be a dangling plot point from the very beginning of the show.
Some intern was going to be searching for ULF2 for like the next 8 months.
Just where is it? We've confirmed all of them except for this, but the report states that they finally confirmed that ULF2 and ULF4 were the same thing.
I bet Goda's just like, you guys fucking realize these are both me, right?
I mean, I know he did because in the car with Sugita, he talked about how if he stayed in rising form for 30 seconds or more than 30 seconds, he would go back to white growing form.
That's fair.
But as Ichijo's looking through the report, Sugita, Sakurai, Nozomi all come up and says like, oh, you know, it's hard not to look back through these things. And the chief comes up and talks about how what a rare breed Godai was.
I'm good boy. How
infectious his personality was. Everyone wonders what he's doing, and they go and they look out the window, except for Ichijo, who stares at the ground because symbolism. And we cut then to another shot of the sky. Camera's starting to pan slightly downwards. And then we're in Popol, and we get just a close-up on the Kuga embroidered apron.
Dude, they legitimately got me with this twice. I was like, huh, it's Godai doing some stuff, and they pan out.
I didn't think it was Godai. I thought it was Jean for some stupid reason.
I didn't get Jean at all.
No, it's Pops.
No, it's Pops.
And Nana comes in, and she apologizes for being late, and she tells him that she got a part.
Yay!
I don't know if it's for a TV show or a movie or what, but she passed the audition, and she has a script in hand. And Pops congratulates her. She comments that during the audition, she was just thinking of Godai, and that's what helped her get it.
Aw.
Pops also says that they got another postcard from Mika, that she got into the high school that she was wanting to get into, and that she's still playing the clarinet. I guess Ichijo tackling a man to the ground didn't traumatize her that much.
That's a temporary thing.
We cut back to the sky, only now we're seeing that it's sky and surf.
Mm-hmm.
This is a beach somewhere, but that's all we get. We cut to a park in Ichikawa, and Seiru is playing soccer. He's kicking a ball around, and Ichijo's talking to Inukita, and she's like, are you really going back to Nagano? And, oh yeah, remember, he's from there.
Yeah, that's where he lives. He was on loan for this investigation.
Yeah.
But he won't be there when boyfriend comes back.
Who knows? Maybe boyfriend will go to Nagano first.
Boyfriend's a free spirit. Might not come back, and that's okay. You love something, you leave the window open, push it out with a broom, and if it flies back in, you're good.
Are you thinking of bats?
I may be thinking of bats.
But while they're talking, Sayuru kicks the soccer ball, and Ichijo chest blocks it and kicks it back to him. And there's no way that child doing that kick sent the ball at Ichijo's chest, but I'll give it to them.
Oh, God, yeah. And they like, skipped across the ground, and they flipped over to Ichijo, and it was bouncing off his chest. It's like, yeah, those two scenes followed each other. Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
But Inukita says that she's doing a better job of being a parent than she has before, that if her and Sayuru wake up early enough that they make pancakes and that they're edible now, or almost edible, I guess was her term. And then she says that they're going to Disneyland tomorrow. We cut back to the beach, and there's now a shadow. We don't see a person. There's a shadow. Clearly someone's standing on the beach.
Dagba.
You're making things up again.
That's a new sound clip. I'm so
right
excited.
Here at the end, we got a new one.
Triggered events for the win.
To be fair, that actually shows up in the Godal episode, but that hasn't been released yet.
Oh. Well, then.
Fair enough. I'm glad after all this time, I still inspire you to have to go find new sound bites to describe my stupidity.
Well, imagine my shaw.
He's on fire.
We cut back to Pol Pol, and Jean is asking for the Godai Yusuke blend. And Pops is like, I don't know what that is. And who should come in? But Mr. Kanzaki, the show has decided he was important.
Yep. He's been promoted significantly since his first appearance.
But apparently, he too is wanting the Godai Yusuke blend.
Yep.
Pops is once again like, I don't like this. They talk some more. Jean reveals that he is going to Disneyland.
I can see what's happening.
What?
And they don't have a clue.
Who?
Somebody else and their child we know going to Disneyland very soon, like tomorrow, perhaps?
Yeah.
Crazy.
Interesting.
Oh, they fucking.
No, seriously, like, we were talking about the lack of romantic chemistry between Godai and Sakurako, but, like, this romance was so much more obvious than what was billed as the obvious romance. Like, yeah. We saw that immediately. It's like, oh, his hair is disheveled.
Nana also, for some reason, compliments Jean's hair, but he hasn't done anything different with it.
I mean, it's just not that into you. Yeah, she's got to pivot her attentions to somebody more literally within 10 feet of her. Godai's out of the room and therefore no longer an option. I think she honestly comments on his hair, though, just because she can't figure out what the fuck is going on with hers. She's like, it looks so orderly. That's so nice. Mine looks like a firework went off on the back of my head.
Hers is something else for this. Mr. Kanzaki decides to bring up that Godai told him that the Godai Yusuke blend was based off of a name?
Kazari Thomas Uburo.
And Jean's like, I didn't hear that. Jean's like, is there any way you could like get in touch with this person? Bob's like, yeah, give me a minute. He walks over to the stairs. He starts to walk up them, calling the person's name. And he turns around and walks back down the stairs. Hey, it's me. And was this the first time in the show we actually heard Pops' full name? Or is he pretending to be this person?
Either he slid fully into his delusions, or no, we never addressed his real identity. It's fucking Batman.
I don't think it was mentioned, but that is in fact his real name.
Nobody asked. The whole series, nobody asked.
Everybody just assumed that, yep, Pops is his name. Even us! So we cut once again back to the beach.
It's becoming beachier.
Shadow is moving. This is the moment where we see the bag hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
We cut to the hospital, and Tsubaki and Ichijo are looking over a series of MRI scans showing various damage and rebuilding of the Amadam belt. And Tsubaki's like, yeah, it really is something. And they talk about how, given how much time has passed, Godai's body will have changed even more.
Tsubaki opens the window because that's Godai's standard form of ingress.
Yep. It's like leaving food at all of the doors to your house when the cat's gone missing.
Yeah.
He's going to come in through one of these.
Yeah, the stray will wander back up to a door. You just have to have it open for him.
Tsubaki has a rather poignant comment, I thought, about how Godai chipped away at his own smile to ensure the protection of everyone else's. And then he pulls out an envelope. We got a letter from Junichi. He doesn't get to appear again, but the show didn't forget about him.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get to read what this letter says.
We do get a switchblade, though.
Yeah, apparently he also sent the switchblade in the envelope. What kind of mail system allows this? Like, it's not packaged, there's no bubble wrap, it was just there in the envelope.
A loose knife in an envelope.
It was 2001.
All right. We weren't worried about those sorts of things yet.
I feel like we were. Oh, who could say?
To be fair, Miyazaki mailed a full katana to Disney as a threat upon the American release of one of his movies just to remind them no cuts.
That was Princess Mononoke, but that was like in a proper box, not just loose in an envelope.
See, I like to think it was just in the front glass of their building.
No, because it was a very nice katana and a card with the words no cuts written in English.
Yeah, the man was serious.
Yeah, he wasn't thrilled with what they'd done to some of the other movies, and no, you're not going to do that to Princess Mononoke. We cut back to the beach, and we see legs walking away from the bag. They're in jeans. We don't see above the waist.
Ooh.
We cut back to Popo. Pops, Nana, Jean, Mr. Kenzaki are all sitting around. They start to discuss how Godai loved clear blue skies. Because when he looked at it, it made him think that the whole world was smiling. And they discuss the symbolism of, like, the limitless potential that the sky represents. They look back at the picture of Mount Everest from a few episodes ago. And Nana walks over to the door and looks out and comments about the sky being clear. Pops comes over and he looks out too, and Kenzaki and Jean come over. And it's intended to be comedic, having each of them in one of the four little window panes in the door. It's a touching moment. We get another shot back. They're still teasing. At the preschool, Ichijo and Minori are just sort of talking through their feelings on what's happened for this last little bit. The kids are all out playing. They've got, like, gardening tools and stuff. They're playing manual labor.
Yes.
And as they're talking, Keiko. Remember Keiko? We say that every time she shows up. Remember Keiko?
Yeah, now she's got a child you forget about as well.
Yeah, she shows up with her baby, and all of the kids run over and are like, do we want to see it? Is this a tiny person? Is it going to get bigger? Yes, you were like this once. One of the kids gives good luck charm that's roughly the size of the baby's face. And there we cut back to the bag on the beach, and we see the charms. At this point, should be super obvious who this person is on the beach, but they still haven't shown it to us yet.
You're making things up again.
We'll continue to do so.
We cut to Jonin University. Ichijo's there with Sakurako, and she informs him that there was another line in the prophecy that says if the fearsome warrior fell to darkness, that the Goram would turn into sand.
convenient.
Really? When were you going to tell us this? Sakurako's like, hey, the Goram's still back at the Institute in one piece, right? Yeah, hasn't turned into sand. Well, then I guess Godai was able to do it, turn into the fearsome warrior, but not let the Holy Spring run dry.
That's just so specific, though, right? This whole time they've been dealing with, like, high metaphor and poetry, like, the warrior's Holy Spring runs dry. This one's just, yo, if he goes evil, the motorcycle's gonna turn into dirt. Like, it's so specific and out of character for everything we've seen so far from this ancient holy script.
I guess they decided that there was no room for metaphor when discussing the failsafes.
If it turns to sand, you're good.
No, you're bad. Things are bad if it turns to sand.
See, this is why we need less metaphor in our prophecies.
And Ichijo brings up that Godai had told him that when he had the vision of Fearsome Warrior, that it was all black. However, when he, Ichijo, saw Godai go into ultimate Kuga form, the eyes were still red. And Sakurako is like, oh, then that means that he was able to hold on to his kindness and hope and not fuel ultimate form with hate.
Sure. Glowing red eyes I often associate with hope and a childlike sense of wonder.
Well, I guess if choosing the glowing red eyes versus, what, glowing black eyes? Yes, red probably is the more hopeful version.
Yeah, probably.
We cut back to the sky above the beach, and there's a fist and comes down, and we finally, as the camera pans down, see that it is Godai laying there on the beach, and he sort of rolls his wrist for a moment. He hears some noise, and he looks over to his right. Down the beach a ways, there are a bunch of kids playing. He gets up and he runs towards them. And he starts juggling for this late 90s, early aughts multi-ethnic group of children.
It is just a full representation of the broad spectrum of humanity.
It's like the Burger King Kids Club.
Dude, I'm telling you, we had so much hope in the 90s. Everything in the 90s depicted everybody from every race, ethnicity, creed, and religion getting along just hunky-dory fine.
We just made it through the Cold War. Surely everything will be better now.
Everything was better forever. It wasn't.
The kids are entertained, except for one little girl who's very critical of him at first, but eventually comes around.
She's seen better beach juggling.
He does some more juggling where he's like tossing the balls to them or pretending to trip and then kicking the ball back up. It's really impressive because they keep the camera on Godai's face. This isn't a stunt performer. This is Joe Odagiri doing these things. And he gives the kids the juggling balls and walks away. And he says goodbye in Spanish and they say goodbye in Italian and then a bunch of other languages. I have no idea where he is.
He's unified the world, Jared. He's done it.
And as he walks along the beach, the ending theme has been playing this entire time, and it ends on the line, and I'll become the blue sky. Camera pans back up, we get the sky, fade out, and instead of a next episode, we get just a scribble, good job, and the thumbs up. And that's it. That's how Kuga ends.
Wow.
This has been a ride.
It has. I gotta say, I very much enjoyed the series overall.
I'd like to suggest Blue Skies.
That's what I was gonna say.
Okay.
So we'll be ranking this on Blue Skies, and we're gonna look at our hero, Godai. And I believe the criteria that we have settled on, somewhat similar to our villains, design, character / personality, and his fighting style. Do you have yours typed up, Jed?
Kuga is a simplistic design, but it's classic. That simplicity makes keeping the variations feeling recognizable while different. And I don't think any of the forms, even basic dragon, are bad designs. I know there are designs I like more, but this is still a strong suit. 4 out of 5. Godai is a character type I don't always like. Happy-go-lucky, everything will be fine if we just believe. Except. The show take a few moments to point out that isn't always true for him, and it gives just enough wrinkles to really make him interesting, especially paired with Odagiri's performance. My only minor complaint is that he doesn't grow throughout the series. He has an arc, but that arc is him holding on to who he is in the face of the horrors he faces. 4.5. The only thing I don't like in Kuga fights is the Blast Pegasus. One and done is not interesting fight material. But everything else, especially his bike foo, I enjoy. Even Titan's relentless march has a charm for me. One finisher rarely used can't lower this 5. That's a 4.5 blue skies for Godai.
All right. Design. So yeah, particularly compared to later series, it's a simplistic design for the rider. But it's a lot nicer visually than the stuff that came before it. This was a good reset from Showa era Kamen Rider, setting the bar, here's what our riders are going to look like. Swapping colors, swapping minor features, adds a bunch without ballooning the budget. I have lamented throughout Gotchard the fact that we get all of these cool concept arts of the different armor forms. We get every form. There's not any hidden special ones that only appear in the books. Each one is distinct. I don't hate Dragon as much as I did.
It's the highest compliment we can expect for you on that form.
It softened on me after I was like, okay, Rising Dragon's pretty cool, actually. All of the Rising forms, Amazing Mighty looks great. Ultimate form is spectacular. Particularly looking at this show in a vacuum, these are great designs. 4.5. Personality, I love our sweet, beautiful golden retriever of a main character. He is the goodest of good boys. I personally like the happy-go-lucky in the face of unimaginable horror for a character. I think it's a great character arc. I don't necessarily think a person has to evolve, but when being faced with adversity, still being able to hold on to who they are and not letting it change them, I think that's great.
I said minor complaint.
Fair. I was not attacking you. I like that. He was spectacular. I've enjoyed his character right from his first moment on screen juggling for that little girl at the airport. Easy 5. Fighting style. I appreciate that for one character, each form having a different fighting style and not just, oh, it's Kuga, but he's doing this now. That's great. That takes a lot of effort on the part of fight choreographers to be like, nope, every version is distinct. I'll agree with you. I liked that first Blast Pegasus. I kind of liked it again, the first one against Burrow, just because it was rapid fire. But yeah, you can't use that one too much. There's really not much to it. The joy of getting to shout it's nerf or nothing, baby, every time. But that's an us.
They brought it back.
Not the show. I think, admittedly, because I don't really think Splash Dragon worked all that well either. But the kicks, particularly once they added in some more of the visual effects, looked really good. Even Titan for just being an impale. I think the fact that they did it so many times and it just didn't work when it did finish off a villain made it more impressive. I think for fighting styles, I'm going to go with, yeah, 4. So with a 4.5, a 5, and a 4, that makes mine a 4.5.
So I'm going to start out with design as well. I very much enjoyed Godai's aesthetic in human form, for sure. The very relaxed attire that he had on always felt the same as his personality. Very mellow. There was minimal investiture in his physical appearance other than being comfortable. And that's very much his personality. You know, I've seen some stuff here and there on the internet, and I've seen some of the suit designs that you sent me. I've seen some of Gotchard. But you're right. These are very clean. I liked that each individual form had baked into it the underpinnings for the eventual growth into the rising forms. That was pretty cool. They included design elements that could make those evolutionary jumps. So he felt very well thought out in terms of the actual aesthetics of the suits. Even starting off with the white form with the smaller horns, and then like developing into more and more powerful forms right up until the point where our last one looked just dangerous as hell. I loved it. I'm going to go with a 4 just because I don't have any frame of reference for it, but I very much enjoyed Godai's human aesthetic as well. Personality? You're absolutely correct. There's something compelling about the character that's able to maintain their humanity despite what they fight. I feel like there was more potential to explore Godai's thinking near the end, because that was an insane moment we had with Jilaji, and then we never really went back and addressed it. And I feel like we lost something there. But all in all, Godai's personality throughout the course, maintaining that static, stable nature, he's the golden retriever. He's just the happy-go-lucky guy who's here to make sure everybody else is okay, no matter what it cost him. And he committed to that, and that was him right up until the end. And there's something strangely comforting about a character who is consistently one thing and at the end of the series goes back to being that one thing because the responsibilities he had to take on are done. I'm going to give him a 4 on that. So fighting style. They did some attempts to make the fighting styles unique between the forms, but I very much feel like we could have fleshed that out a lot more. Pegasus was Pegasus. You know, we line up, we shoot somebody. But I'm thinking in particular, Titan felt unique. Dragon form and Mighty form didn't feel that different from me in terms of their fighting style or their approach to combat. One was stronger, one was faster, but in terms of the practical combat, we didn't really ever feel that difference so much. We started to, in the very early game, we first introduced Blue. We covered the extra reflexes and that kind of thing. I think I agree with Jared in that Blue was probably weakest, and it's blasé, not really much to it, kind of bled into others for me.
For me, it was particularly like his stance changed no matter what form. He had a particular stance he took when he was in Mighty. He had a different one for when he was in Dragon. And sure, like different weapons can change how you would do something, but typically a person's stance is their stance.
I guess I would have liked to see something make the Blue form a little more unique. So I feel like there was room for this to be polished a little more on fighting style. So I am going to go with a 4. And that's 4s across the board for me. So that's a 4.
That gives us a 4.1666 repeating. Blue Skies for Godai. For the first Kamen Rider that we get in this new era, that's a good bar. Honestly, anything above a 3 would have been good, because, hey, this is the standard we're setting. Jed, I believe now it's episode as a whole.
Some of the scenes got a little heavy-handed with the message. And the Blue Sky motif bordered on overused. But it was still nice to see where people ended up at the end of the series. There are some choices I don't like, but that doesn't make them wrong or bad. I liked it, but not as much as I could have. 4. This is another solid entry in Kuga's cinematography. Whereas the last two episodes were dark and cloudy in the wake of Daguva's destruction, this episode was bright and cheerful. I'm pretty sure it's the brightest episode of the series. Everything feels warm and cozy. It's a 5 out of 5. There is no fight. But I won't hold that against it, so I'll just give fights a not applicable.
I was wondering how we were going to do that one.
Yeah, I think that's valid. A 0's going to tank the score for the episode.
That gives this final episode a 4.5 from me.
So, plot. It's a nice feel-good episode. I don't necessarily agree with all the choices. I think they milked the Godai reveal more than maybe they should have. But it's nice to see everyone happy. 3.5. And then cinematography, it's right there with what we've come to expect from Kuga. I have no complaints. At the same time, it didn't have any shots that wow me. So I think for that, I'm going to go with a 4. And then, yeah, not applicable because the fighting is done. So that should put mine at a 3.75 Blue Skies.
So then for me, definitely did a better job with the farewells to each character than we did with the saying goodbye to each character. However, this did feel a little, what's the word I want to use here? Not melodramatic, but the whole thing felt kind of
draggy.
Yeah. Like, there's air brakes going on. It was nice to see where everybody ended up. We had the warm fuzzies. But at the end of the day, there was nothing really unique. We were all just saying goodbye and establishing where everybody was. We didn't really drive much plot home. So it's a 3. It's an average. Cinematography, just like Jared said, there was nothing that really stood out. Nothing shiny, sparkle, sparkle. But it was consistently good. There was great visual storytelling. You're absolutely correct, Jetty, in that like the visual storytelling at play here did a wonderful job of pivoting back to the bright from the dim. We got this just refresh. There's a hopeful atmosphere that everything is okay now. And Godai gets to move on. So it's going to be a 4 for me on cinematography. So that's a 3.5 for me.
That gives this last episode a 3.91666 repeating Blue Skies.
It's going to be weird to move on.
It is, which is why we aren't quite yet. Join us next week for a look back over Kuga as a whole and a look forward to Agito.
You can reach us by email at commentarytrack@gmail.com or on Twitter at commentarytrack. You can support us at patreon.com/thecommentarytrack, where you get access to our running commentary for every episode and bi-monthly-ish bonus episodes.
I say a whole lot of things, Jerry. I cannot be held accountable for everything I say.
Touche.
I know enough. There's a recording, but I'm still not accountable.